From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Plans are a go for Secretary of State Colin Powell to meet with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat this weekend. He's expected to meet with Israel's Ariel Sharon on Friday. The world waits with bated breath for Powell to pull some miracle of superpower influence out of his visit, but no one, perhaps not even Powell himself, knows what that miracle might be. And as a region teeters on the brink of wider war, Powell may deliver nothing. I spoke a short time ago with Cameron Barr. He's Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. I asked him what Colin Powell can expect to find when he arrives in Israel Friday.
Well, he's going to find himself in a situation where events, I think, are conspiring against him. The suicide bombing in Haifa today will make it more difficult for the Israelis to withdraw from their operations in the West Bank. And in fact, the Prime Minister made it very clear today that the Israelis would not stop those operations in any way until they were judged to be completed. He also finds a situation in which a recent ambush of Israeli soldiers in one of the refugee camps in the West Bank will probably draw out the Israeli presence in Palestinian parts of the West Bank, because the Israeli Defense Forces will want to move more cautiously, more slowly, in order to protect their troops from possible attack. It seems as if the worst of the fighting is over. In the old city of Nablus and in the refugee camp next to the town of Jenin in the northern West Bank, those were the two areas in which the Israelis faced their stiffest resistance, and they seem to have basically asserted control today over those two areas. But at the same time, the urge to caution, I think, is very strong on the part of the Israeli military, since they suffered their highest losses in a single event the other day since 1982, I believe.
Does it look then, Cameron, that in spite of calls from President George Bush and many others around the world for Israel to withdraw, does it look as though the Israeli offensive will still be fully underway when Colin Powell arrives in Israel?
I think there might be a toning down of actions, a calming of the situation. But I don't think there'll be any substantive withdrawal beyond the two towns that the Israelis pulled out of a couple of days ago. I think that the Israelis feel like there's much more work to be done in all the places where they are now present, and that they want to continue to do that work. I spoke to an Israeli soldier today in Ramallah, whom I know personally, and he said that what he was hearing was a couple of weeks in that, and they've been in Ramallah longer than they've been in any of the other places that they now occupy.
How do you think the two sides, the Israeli government and the Palestinians, are anticipating Powell's arrival? What are they going to be telling him? What do they expect him to tell them?
Well, I think the Palestinians see it as an opportunity to reestablish some sort of diplomatic engagement, and also as a means to pressure the Israelis to pull back from this offensive, first of all. I think the Israelis may want to impress upon him their need to continue with the operation. And as I said earlier, the suicide bombing today will only add fuel to that fire. They will say, look, in spite of all that we have done, we're still getting these attacks, and you must give us the leeway to continue to deal with them in the best way we know. I talked to an Israeli soldier today who has been involved in the fighting in Jenin, and he's been going house to house in his armored personnel carrier searching for weapons and for bomb-making materials, and he told me that his soldiers had found those things in the Jenin refugee camp. And he also said that he thought the mission was a success because there had not been a terrorist attack inside Israel proper in 8 days. And I said to him, well, what about Haifa this morning? And he said, well, that just shows that we need to keep doing what we're doing in order for the mission to be effective.
What will Secretary Powell's, what will the circumstances of his meeting with Arafat actually be? Will it be in this single room or two surrounded by Israeli military?
It's not clear yet. I mean, the American officials are describing it as a security nightmare, which, I mean, you have to take them seriously. On one recent occasion, the consul general, the American consul general in West Jerusalem, sort of the de facto ambassador to the Palestinians, delivering a letter, I think, from President Bush to Yasser Arafat, and was in Arafat's compound. This was some weeks ago, at the same time as the Israelis fired rockets into another building in the compound. So there's a clear and present danger for anyone to be in that compound. I think with the Secretary of State, there may be some advance warning that was not present in the case of the Consul General. But at the same time, it's going to be very difficult to get him in and out of there in a way that the Americans will feel comfortable with. But that's what we're expecting to see at this stage.
And at this point, Cameron, we know you've been on the ground talking with a lot of people. What is the standing of the United States in the region? How much clout is Colin Powell seen as bringing to this crisis?
Well, I think he's bringing the only clout available. As much as the Americans are vilified, especially now on the streets of the Arab world, as far as doing a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the Americans are still the only game in town. I mean, these are historical truths that haven't gone away. The Arabs recognize that the Americans are the only ones who can pressure the Israelis in such a way as to bring them to compromise. And it's for that reason that the Americans are always seen as the sort of inevitable broker. And on the Palestinian side, it's America that confers legitimacy to a large extent on the Palestinian government. I mean, I think Yasser Arafat had no greater pleasure than to spend the night in the White House, which he did many, many times during the Clinton administration. And if he can get some face time, if you'll pardon the expression, with the Secretary of State, that will do much to restore his legitimacy and to make him appear to be the main man, the central player among the Palestinians, which is precisely the thing that the Israelis have sought to take away from him.
Cameron Barr is Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem.
I think we are all in agreement, I think the world is in agreement, that there will not be a solution that will be produced by terror or will be produced by a response to terror. This is not going to get us there. What will get us there are political discussions, and the sooner we can get to them, the better. Now, I have to speak to the parties in the region at greater length to see how they view this matter and to see how we can go forward. And in due course, I'm sure that we will let the whole world know what we believe is the proper way to go forward. Violence of whatever form, whether one would call it an act of terrorism or an act of resistance at this point, is counterproductive.
Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking today in Madrid. Terror or counterterror, he says, the violence must give way to a new political dialogue. That's the administration's new tack. So much is riding on Powell's trip. It's high profile around the world, and despite the secretary's best efforts to downplay it, the trip carries enormous expectations. But the Bush administration has been so hesitant to actively engage in the Middle East. What can Powell offer now? How far can even superpower diplomacy go? What can Colin Powell possibly bring to the table? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me tonight from New York City is William Beeman. He's professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Good evening and welcome, William Beeman.
Nice to be here again.
It's great to have you back. William Beeman, poor Colin Powell, it's been a kind of a trail of tears on his way toward Israel and the West Bank all this week. It's hard to imagine rougher going, the violence going on day after day, even as his president, George W. Bush, calls for the Israelis to withdraw, calls for the Palestinians to give up terror. It goes on and on. What is riding at this point on Powell's shoulders on this trip?
He has practically been designated as the savior of the situation. Hmm. And the Bush administration has made him the point man in Israel. Unfortunately for Powell, as able a person as he is and as admired as he is in the region, chances of failure are really very great, given the fact that he's going there absolutely alone. He is the Secretary of State. He's not the Secretary of Defense. He is not, it seems, able to commit troops, either American troops or international troops. And quite honestly, that is what is needed at this point. We are facing a situation that is every bit as volatile as the situation in, for instance, Africa some years ago, in Rwanda and Burundi, where we have two ethnic groups that are at each other's throats. They don't seem to be willing to let up. And to have Powell there by himself without any ability to actually bring in the heavy guns, I think is going to be really very, very difficult for him.
Can you imagine Colin Powell sitting down with Sharon and Yasser Arafat and saying, The planes are in the air. They're going to be U.S. paratroopers here within a week. We're going to separate you two combatants. Is that at all possible? Or if not, what's the trend line in U.S. involvement here? Where are we headed?
Here's the difficulty. The Israeli government has always been treated by the United States as an equal partner in the Middle East. And it's going to be an extremely difficult thing for Colin Powell to sit down with Sharon and treat him and treat the Israeli government like a lesser power, dictate to them. We have really eschewed doing that in the past. And the Israeli government has been very proud and has pointed up many, many times that we are that their government is the equal of the United States. They are a modern Western nation. They have all the trappings of modern life. It would be, for instance, as if the American government went and dictated to the Prime Minister of France.
But Ariel Sharon is clearly not going to be open. I mean, let's set aside just for a second the idea of American troops landing, and that's maybe a far-fetched scenario, but maybe not so far-fetched. But Ariel Sharon has said only today that this military action had to go on, despite what President Bush has said, until the militias in the Palestinian areas were crushed. He said, you can talk all about peace, but you cannot reach peace as long as terror exists.
Well, that's a line of rhetoric. And quite honestly, somebody's got to step back. And right now, the two sides are so angry at each other and so emotionally involved with their struggle that they really can't see a way out where where one individual is actually going to take the first step backwards. That's why there needs to be an intermediary. The United States is the only intermediary, as Cameron Barr said earlier in the interview that you just had with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we must prove our bona fides in being the kind of intermediary that really cares about both sides and is willing to do the tough action that's necessary in order to separate them. And I should point out that this kind of action is actually culturally quite appropriate in the Middle East.
What do you mean by that, William Beeman?
Well, when we have two parties that are feuding with each other, that are fighting with each other, they actually expect to have someone come in and hold them back from each other.
You're an anthropologist, so we want to take your word for that. But give us an example, or how might that work in another circumstance?
The question really is a matter of honor. In a situation, the first person who comes up and apologizes is in fact admitting that he was wrong, that he was guilty, and he loses face. And so both parties have to maintain their strong stand against each other when they have a really genuine feud. In order to avoid losing honor or losing face. The only thing that can happen in a situation like this to make it stop is for a third party to come in and forcibly separate them. And this is how things are done every day in villages and in cities throughout the region.
But as you say, Israel has not seen itself as any kind of minor player, but as a fully sovereign state, and indeed it is. And you could even make the argument, I suppose, that it's not exactly fully representative of Middle Eastern culture. This is also a European culture, as you said, a country that sees itself on a par with France or Italy and does not want to be dictated to by the United States.
Well, the question of the identity of Israel has always been a matter of question. At times, Israel has wanted to stake out a claim for itself as a Middle Eastern nation. Most often in recent times, it has staked out a claim for itself as being a European nation. However, a large proportion of the Israeli population are, in fact, Middle Easterners. They are people who, paradoxically for an American audience, because we don't really think about this, whose first language was Arabic and who grew up in Middle Eastern countries. And so they may be Jewish, but they take on the characteristics of the region.
What a minefield Secretary Powell is walking into as he slow walks toward Israel and the West Bank right now. What should Colin Powell bring to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict this week? Does the Secretary of State have a prayer of breaking through the violence? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're anticipating Secretary of State Colin Powell's arrival in Israel later this week. It's been a tough week in setting after setting. He's been buffeted, and the United States has been given the back of the hand by Arab governments saying, you are not stepping up in the right way to solve this problem. At the same time, Israel has ignored George W. Bush's repeated calls for an end to the Israeli offensive in the West Bank. Today in Madrid, the United States was joined by the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia in calling on Israel to withdraw from Palestinian cities immediately and in urging Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to do everything possible to halt attacks against Israeli civilians. But is anybody listening? What does Powell, what does the United States have to offer to put out the fire in the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by William Beaman. He's professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University. William Beaman, you were saying before the break that in your view, the only thing to do now is to bring in troops, bring in U.S. troops. We've talked about that on this show before. Callers have almost universally said, no way. How might that ever happen?
The reason that our callers have objected to the sending in of U.S. troops is because of a difficulty that we have in our own society, in our own culture, with carrying out precisely that action. And this is the dilemma that Colin Powell and our president faces. We are culturally not disposed to doing the kind of thing that needs to be done. And there something really has to change because we are the only party that can do something. The United States during this century has been reluctant to commit our troops to foreign wars. In fact, we can go back to George Washington and talk about that. It's almost a cultural characteristic of ours. The anthropologist Margaret Mead in 1942 wrote about this. She said, when we do it, we kind of hold our nose. We declare it to be a sort of a job that has a very short span in terms of time. We go in and we do it and we remove ourselves as soon as we possibly can because we find it distasteful. And this is so it's not surprising that the American public in the polls is going to resist this kind of effort. And yet it really is the only thing that needs to be done.
How close do you think Colin Powell could come to actually proposing this on this trip just 3 days from now?
I think he could propose it at any time. The question is, does he have the mandate to propose it? And does he have permission from the White House to propose it?
Can you imagine that he does?
He's a military man. I can imagine that he might have carte blanche, might have a blank check. My feeling is that the White House knows how unpopular this would be, and they would have to risk the elections in the fall in order to be able to carry out such an action. Mm. No question that there would be a backlash on the part of the American public. The Americans would hate it.
We're asking what on earth Colin Powell can do, will do when he arrives in Israel at the end of this week. What influence does the United States have in the Middle East now, and how should it be used? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
How are you tonight?
We're well, thanks.
I have two thoughts about this. The first one is I can't imagine a kind of a blue or a yellow line, a border where the Israelis would agree to place American troops, even if that was to be supported by an American administration, because it would create a de facto the de facto borders of a future Palestinian state, and that's to be negotiated between two parties. It doesn't seem realistic. The other one is I think that you should be looking 2 or 3 months down the road, that it's not one particular leader who's been vilified. Sharon has got support from people who abhorred his biography. So much has changed since 1982, and what you really have is a government of national unity that's kind of been lashed together by Hamas and the PLO and Iran. So Israel, as a grown-up country now, a country that you know you might even want to call a first-world country, can in fact sacrifice American monetary and political support. And what will happen 2 or 3 months ago when Israel finally crushes what is left of the terrorist infrastructure is likely to be a kind of a stalemate, and that's where perhaps the European Union and perhaps the United States might have some kind of influence and force. But there's no way now that they can impose anything.
So you're saying, Steve, let the effort roll because it's necessary. United States, stay out of the way.
One thing that Barack said, Prime Minister Barack, who essentially sacrificed his political future by making that proposal, is Arafat took away, we the Israelis, took off Yasser Arafat's mask. And so many people who might have had dovish and compromised attitudes over the past 12 years, as I might have had that as an outsider looking in, there's not much of that left.
Steve, thank you for your call. Bill Beeman, what about it? It's not only a view in Israel. Conservative columnists in the United States have agreed. George Will writes today that the Bush administration is making a terrible mistake by trying to rein in the Israeli effort to root out terror.
The difficulty is that the Palestinians have nowhere to go. They will fight until the last man. There is no the effort to root out terror is going to be a never-ending effort.
But is that exactly true? There's been even speculation that Israel would like to see the Palestinians go to Jordan.
Of course, the Palestinians were once in Jordan, if you remember. The West Bank was part of Jordan at one time.
In Jordan, in what's now Israel, all over the region, I guess. But
precisely. But just as the Israeli government decries a move that would, quote, push Israel into the sea, one wonders about the morality and ethics of a move that would completely eradicate the Palestinian population in the West Bank and push them across the Jordan into Jordan or into some other country.
There are a lot of extremes on the table. We're wondering if Colin Powell can find a moderate middle way. Bill Beeman, stand by. We're joined now by Richard Murphy. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He's former Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Good evening and welcome, Richard Murphy.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Richard Murphy, put yourself in the shoes of Colin Powell for us tonight. What is he thinking as he approaches Israel and the West Bank? And what are, what should be the goals of this trip?
Well, he staged the trip in such a way that he's touched bases with every one of the principal moderate Arab leaders, as well as with the Europeans. And obviously he did so to try to generate from them messages to the Palestinian leader, to Yasser Arafat, that yes, this is the time to move to halt the violence.
From the outside looking in, it doesn't look like he got those messages from the Arab leaders.
He has nothing yet in public. I'm not sure what he's had in private there and what their communications are. But that's got to be the principal reason he went that way instead of jetting straight from Washington to Israel, to Tel Aviv airport and up to Jerusalem.
There's been a lot of speculation that, in fact, those many steps were left in the trip to give Israel time to complete what the Bush administration may privately think is important rooting out work in the West Bank.
Well, you know, I've heard that. I can't rule it out absolutely, but I'd say this, that Israel announced it had a 7-week program ahead, and it's now scarcely a week into that program. Now, I find it very hard to believe that Israel is going to find it to its advantage, long-run advantage, to stand up and face down the United States' views that this is not in Israel's long-term interest to keep this operation going for the month ahead.
Ambassador Murphy, in Madrid today, Secretary of State Colin Powell made a statement that sounded like it could be a significant change in policy. I don't have the exact words in front of me, but paraphrasing, he was saying it doesn't matter if the violence is terror or counter-terror. It all has to give way to political dialogue. This almost sounded like we can't wait for ceasefire. We have to go straight to political dialogue. Did you hear that from Madrid?
I heard the same thing. I heard that we have had a mantra for the last almost a year now saying follow the yellow brick road through the Tenet ceasefire provisions to the Mitchell Commission report and on to the table. It seems to me that he's saying we have to do something more immediately. And he used the word instantly, linking Tenet, linking Mitchell to negotiations. We have to give a clearer assurance, a clearer vision to particularly the Palestinians, but also to the Israelis, that negotiations are going to pay and it's the only way to go. So let's get there.
So presumably, Colin Powell has watched this go on and on and on. He knows how adamant both parties are. He presumably doesn't want to come and just try and jawbone people with the same old arguments. What do you think he might have in his pocket to pull out for Ariel Sharon, for Yasser Arafat? What might he say to break this bloody entanglement?
I don't think he's going to be threatening either party. I mean, he's not that sort of fellow. I think that with the Israelis, he speaks with the voice, with the backing of the American president. The Israelis do not want to alienate the United States. Their electorate will not stand for that. A prime minister who cannot manage the American card in the game is in trouble. And I think that the history of that will be very much on Ariel Sharon's mind as Powell arrives.
But at this point, what does alienating the United States mean? Prime Minister Sharon could not be more clear than he was today in saying, we don't care what the White House said. We're going to go on with this because we must go on with this. And to make it especially difficult for George W. Bush, he's essentially using the language of Bush's own war on terror when he defies the White House.
Well, President Bush has made clear he does not accept Sharon's identification of Yasser Arafat with Osama bin Laden. It's not the same situation. It's an entirely different affair. There is terrorism there, and terrorism practiced by these suicide bombers, yes. But it's not the same situation as fighting al-Qaeda. And I think the Bush administration has very carefully kept the distinction up in front as it's moved in the Middle East. Mm.
Professor Beeman, when Ambassador Murphy says Israel cannot, will not ultimately alienate the United States, where are we in that relationship right now?
I think Ambassador Murphy is certainly correct that Israel absolutely depends on the United States, and maybe it depends on the United States too much. I was interested in the other caller, Steve, who had suggested that somehow down the road that Israel would in fact forego U.S. Support and financial backing. I think that really is not in the cards, and I think Ambassador Murphy is correct that Ariel Sharon or any politician in Israel that would alienate the United States and risk this lifeline that we provide. After all, we provide an enormous amount of financial support for Israel. It probably couldn't survive unless we were there. Such a politician would be quickly out of office.
Bill Beeman, Richard Murphy, stand by. Let's turn to the phones. Abdul is on the line. Welcome, Abdul. You're on the air.
I'm an Iranian-American, been here 27 years.
Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. Same here. Yeah, I watch this war closely. I think there's no solution but what Colin Powell intend to do. I think it's the right thing. We should deploy American forces and later on possibly replace him by United Nations forces down there, and that would be the short-term solution. And long-term would be we should, declare that area part of your world community, and no other country can have power over that independent area that should be run by council of churches or whatever.
But Abdul, do you think that American forces or any forces can stop suicide bombing attacks into Israel?
If it's combined with the other forces, like Turkish forces and stuff, yeah, they could, or Egyptian forces, yeah. It can be done.
Abdul, thanks so much for your call. Richard Murphy, here's this issue again. Bill Meeman has raised it. Abdul raises it. The issue is, should international forces, U.S. forces, be put between these combatants to separate them and work toward peace?
I think Washington is a long ways away from the idea of deploying American forces to make peace. Powell is ready to follow up on what the president suggested at the G8 meeting last year to deploy U.S. monitors. Now, if that can lead into a multinational force acceptable to both sides, I think we'd be very, very happy to see that happen. But inserting American forces to be a fighting force between those two, no way.
Bill Beeman.
May I add something here? I think that the difficulty that we have in the United States, a secondary difficulty, is that we do not want to see American troops commandeered by anybody else. We don't even want to see a dishwasher in the army commandeered by a foreign general. And so we also don't want to intervene ourselves, so that if we can do anything to get international troops involved in the region, we probably will work toward that rather than committing our own troops, and certainly not putting them under the control of any other foreign generals or foreign powers.
Mm. Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I love the program, and I appreciate being on it. There's nothing more annoying than an overly simplistic view of a very complicated problem.
Mm-hmm.
But as a litigator and as somebody who's been involved in settlements of disputes, admittedly not nearly as complex as this, one thing that strikes me is the fact that the press is playing a dramatic role in inhibiting the ability of these two parties to formulate a strategy.
How exactly is that happening, Eric, in your view?
In essence, what you have is a situation where, for the first time, because of technology and Al Jazeera and all of these different media that allow both sides to see the hand of the other. There's a wonderful line by Winston Churchill, I hope I'm phrasing it correctly, mm-hmm. where he said that the diplomacy is the art of letting them get your way. And where you have a stalemate here, a situation where both sides really have reached a point where there's very little bargaining chip, if any bargaining chip, left, they have to form some mechanism for leading the other person. And it may seem corrupt, the other side, it may seem corrupt, but really the other side has to be led at some point to believe that they're giving something up that they're really not. And when you have a media that exchanges information so frequently and so quickly, you literally have the most rapid balancing, a balancing of each other's powers in such a way that it's difficult to see how they can make any progress.
But even Hezbollah has its own satellite television broadcasting going on now with images of the Israeli invasion going all over the Middle East.
You're absolutely right. And all of this is literally like playing poker against someone and having somebody walk around the table and comment on the cards that each one is holding. How is any party supposed to provide a strategy or provide an opportunity to settle when the other side is seeing all of those cards?
Mm. Eric, it's a tough point. Thanks for bringing it to us. Richard Murphy, what about it? All the world's media is focused here. Arab media is showing these terrible images. On the other side, we see the results of Palestinian suicide bombing. Does this paralyze the negotiation process?
It makes it darn difficult. But I think the message that Powell has been repeating throughout this trip is that force from either side isn't going to get what they want, isn't going to get the Palestinian state that they want, isn't going to get the total security that Israel wants. The force is not the answer. Now, that may be a hard sell. It's a very emotional scene. I was very struck yesterday by Sharon's statement that this was now a battle for the existence of Israel and the survival of the mm-hmm. Jewish people. Mm-hmm. I think that's way out beyond the realities of today.
But those are the words of Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. We're talking about Powell, Secretary Powell's imminent arrival later this week in Israel and the West Bank. Put yourself in Colin Powell's shoes. What are you thinking tonight? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're anticipating Secretary of State Colin Powell's arrival in Israel later this week tonight, trying to put ourselves in the Secretary of State's shoes, asking what can he do. We're joined by William Beeman, Professor of Anthropology and Mideast Studies at Brown University, and by Richard Murphy, former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and Syria. You're welcome as well. Is anyone listening to the United States as Secretary Powell approaches? Is even Israel listening? And if it's not, what hope does Powell have of wielding influence in this conflict? Should the Secretary of State be thinking outside the box, bringing breakthrough ideas? Like what? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Murphy, I want to ask you, what do you think, realistically, what is Colin Powell going to say? We've talked about things that he may not say, but what will he say that gives him a chance of making a difference on Friday and Saturday?
I think with the Israeli leadership, he'll say, you don't want, you don't need, and in fact you can't afford a prolonged confrontation with the United States. And to the Palestinian leadership, you are sacrificing any hopes of improving your prospects for attaining a state, and in fact, you're indefinitely delaying that, and you're succeeding only in the destruction of both the infrastructure of the Palestine Authority, but a ever-growing number of deaths on the Palestinian side. And is that what you really want?
Mm. There's a message. Its impact, well, we'll see what it might be. Larry's on the line. Welcome, Larry. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. It appears to me that you're talking about two equal parties that have to be sat down and talk, you know, told the rules. When we're dealing with all the Arab countries are dictators and oligarchs, Israel is the only true democracy. They've had left-wing governments, centrist, right-wing governments negotiating with the Palestinians, and Barak ended up with these terror attacks after he gave them what he felt was enormous concessions, and they didn't continue bargaining. They just started fighting. So what makes your speakers think that the Palestinians, at least the leadership, I don't know about the little people in the streets, but the leadership really wants to make peace when look what how they're behaving, and look at their website, and you will see there's nothing there about an accommodation with Israel. Their maps show Israel doesn't exist.
Larry, I'm going to put that to our guests tonight, but let me ask you first. Ambassador Richard Murphy was saying that Colin Powell should or will say to Israel, you cannot afford to lose the support of the United States. Do you think that the Israeli government will hear that as a realistic threat? Do you think that Colin Powell will even deliver that threat?
He will, and they probably will back down a little bit, and then there'll be some more suicide attacks because that's the goal of Hamas, is to destroy Israel and keep it up no matter what. Even in Lebanon, where they pulled out, they're still doing it. Mm. So they'll have to pull back a little to make Powell and the Americans happy, and then when they say, look what happens when we pull back, they'll have to go in again. And now he's going to say, can we finish the job just like you're doing in Afghanistan? Allow us to do the Powell Doctrine says you go in with brute force and you take control. That's what he said before he came to office.
Larry, we got it, and thank you for your call. Thank you very much. Bill Beeman, how about it? This Larry says that Ariel Sharon is simply exercising the Powell Doctrine in his purest form. He's defined a goal. He's got the power to carry it off, and he's in the midst of doing it. The United States cannot and should not stop him.
In this particular situation, it's not going to work. And the reason is because the Palestinian population has been driven to desperation. And in their resistance, they really are more like unto the people of Algeria under French occupation, the people of India under British occupation. And I'm afraid that Israel is actually going to lose this one. Because the Palestinians are really determined at this point to resist with all their might, and every occupying force in the 20th century that has taken this strong arm approach has eventually lost, and I think that's a really important lesson for Ariel Sharon to learn. And I'd also like to respond to the caller's statement. I'm very tired of hearing people say that. Because Israel is supposedly the only democratic state in the Middle East, therefore that's somehow a calling card or a.
What do you find tiring in that?
Well, because it doesn't really demonstrate anything. I mean, the fact that Israel is a democracy.
We do put some value on democracy, though.
Well, we do indeed, but we also put value on refraining from genocidal actions on the part of a government.
Are you calling Israel genocidal?
Well, there's an interesting question about what the Israeli actions in the West Bank really are resulting in. I have been there myself and seen houses bulldozed, and I've seen people shot.
But what about national right to self-defense? Many Israelis have died from suicide bombings and other terrorist actions.
No question that a national right to self-defense definitely exists. And the question is, when does the defense turn into an offense? And I think that's a very fine line that's being debated in Israel today by many, many Israeli citizens.
And no doubt in the White House as well. Andrea's calling from New York City. Welcome, Andrea. You're on the line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I appreciate being able to not only listen, but I've really carefully attempted to keep up with the media with what's been happening. And I have two thoughts, but there are actually also questions. The first thought is one of your screeners said this has been something that you've been discussing all along, and that is why are we interfering in effect with Israel's domestic issues.
You think we should just stay out of it?
And and that's partly my thought. And your guest has actually commented about that. However, what Americans have been doing it all along as taxpayers is in effect really underwriting Israel's defense, so to speak, and offense too. And it's perhaps because there's a billion or more Muslims in the world and really very few Israelis, and they have been very hostile. However, if perhaps, and this is just a supposition, and I'm curious about your guest's thoughts, if we do pull back and we allow the Israelis to, in effect, go right back to the borders that had been mandated with what the UN had given them in 48, if we allow them, and keep in mind that any other people under tyranny would literally leave. I mean, my ancestors left when Trotsky went through the Ukraine.
So, Andrea, come to your bottom line, because we're running short of time. You're saying the U.S. should support Israel or not?
Actually, perhaps as taxpayers, although we would support them by allowing them to finish their action, should we as taxpayers continue to underwrite them financially with what they've been doing? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Andrea, thanks for your call. Richard Murphy here's, I guess, an American taxpayer saying there's a question in her mind whether she wants to continue to support Israel. Is this really going to become an active issue with Colin Powell on Friday?
No, I don't think so, because I see no signs of the American public, certainly not the American Congress, being ready to sanction Israel. The Europeans are talking about some kind of economic sanction, but the United States, I'm sure, is not going to join in that. But let me just say, your previous caller, I think, was right on when he described the goal of Hamas to destroy the Jewish state as a state. However, what Powell has to be doing is finding that common ground between the Israelis and the Palestinians that will allow Arafat to shrink Hamas back to its normal dimensions, which is not by any means a majority of Palestinian opinion. And he can only do that by giving a clearer political guarantee, commitment of the United States to work for the Palestinian state.
Well, that's all we've got time for tonight. Richard Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And William Beeman, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're most welcome.
In a moment, a voice from Ramallah. Since the Israeli army isolated Yasser Arafat in his compound nearly 2 weeks ago, Lois Nockley has sent email updates about daily life in Ramallah to her friends around the world. She's an American. She moved to Ramallah 5 years ago with her Palestinian husband. In the next few days, we'll be hearing personal stories from people on both sides of the conflict in Israel. Tonight, Lois Nockley shares an entry from her email diary with us.
Dear all, every sound has a new meaning, especially machines in the sky. We hear the deep hum of a commercial plane coming way before we see it. Our eyes need to follow it a long way across the sky just to make sure it is really going to only pass over us. The higher-pitched groan of helicopters is a sound that is heard first before we hear the twirling sound of the propellers. This sound alerts us that imminent danger is possible. F-16s are clearly unmistakable. We look up ahead of the sound because they fly so fast. Our bodies tense in relation to the height we determine they are flying at. Very high, they are going somewhere else. Middle height is uncertain. Maybe they are trying to scare us, or maybe they will turn around and return lower. If they are low, we expect an awful bomb in our city somewhere. Right now, there is a drone. These unmanned planes are taking photos of us, and we all wish we could shoot them down. We are now just as spooked by the quiet times as by the times of shooting and bombing. The quiet is misleading and feels surreal as I look out my windows and see empty streets. They have been taken by the cats and birds. I saw a wild bird clearly walking in the street and then do a magnificent run, jump, takeoff yesterday. But my binoculars, which I use for bird watching, were in the other room, so I missed a closer look. I use the binocs for tank watching these days. The birds are even mating in the street. There are no dogs. What has happened to all the wild dogs that would wander around all the time? The songs of the birds, and now the sunshine is so beautiful, it adds to the surrealness. Unfortunately, one sound that has not stopped is the constant movement of the tanks in town. We hear them going what seems like round and round in town. I keep thinking of the people who live directly in the city and have had 11 days of this fearsome noise outside their windows. The tanks rarely come to our neighborhood these days, and sometimes it feels safe to step outside our doors. Yesterday afternoon, Khalil and I went out to our garden alongside our building to weed the mauvaises. After 15 minutes, there was shooting from M16s, but we decided to ignore it, so much our need be in the garden. But maybe too many people were doing the same thing as us. The Army was sure to let us know we must stay inside. Rapid fire of machine guns from tanks started, and it sounded as if it was just over the hill from us. We got afraid. I started pulling weeds so fast, and then we just quickly went into the house. People are telling a frequent sniper shot at people who are outside in their yards. My friend's friend was sitting at the front steps of her house, and they were shot at. Also, three small children in the backyard were shot at. Many stories like this. Sometimes they hit the children. Something terrible is happening in Jenin, and we are getting so little information. Keeping the media out of there makes it seem to come true the fears I had in the beginning. What can be happening to those families that live in that camp? We were so frightened by the operation here, and I believe it is much more intense there. Israel is saying our men hide behind women and children. It makes me so angry. Where else can they be? We are allowed to go nowhere except where we live. I saw a woman giving an account of her ordeal to a TV reporter. She was holding her 4-year-old daughter. The child listened while looking at the camera, then brought her body around to directly look into her mother's face. She held her look and listened to the words of her mother. I saw before me permanent imprint on that child. The news keeps talking about something being done to stop all this. Sometime this week, maybe. But here the people, and especially the children, will not forget this just because the Israeli army will pull out. The future of this area is being determined by what these children witness, not by what they are promised.
That was Ramallah resident Lois Nockley in the first of two diaries we'll be hearing this week from people living on both sides of the conflict in Israel. We want to have your story on our program. How is your life being affected by what you're reading, seeing, and hearing? Send us an email, onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.